What is it about these three G's and an E flat, three eighth notes and a half note, that are so pregnant and so meaningful that a whole symphonic movement can be born?
Leonard Bernstein asked the question in 1954, and people are still wondering, what is it about those first four notes of what may be the most popular symphony ever written?
Music critic Matthew Guerrieri ranged across hundreds of years of history in search of the answer. His new book is The First Four Notes, Beethoven's Fifth and the Human Imagination. Matthew Guerrieri joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
So tell us, Beethoven began writing the Fifth, I believe, in 1804. Is that right?
Yeah, more or less. He worked on it on and off. The initial sketches for it turn up around 1804, and then he would sort of come to it and then go away from it. He eventually finished it in time for a very large concert he put on himself at the end of 1808. So there was quite a long gestation period for it.
Well, it's interesting because of the time frame. In the book, you write that the idea of structuring an entire piece of music around basically what's a four-note scaffolding, that idea is really of its time because it reaches back into 1789 and the French Revolution. How is that?
Well, this was a rhythm. The rhythm of the motive is one that turns up an awful lot in French Revolutionary songs and also in a particular genre of music that French composers produced for large sort of propaganda events that the French Revolutionary governments would put on. And Beethoven knew some of this music, and he also admired many of the composers who were writing this music. There's one in particular named Méhul who wrote a symphony right around the same time as the Fifth Symphony in which the final movement uses almost the exact same motive and builds it up in a very similar way. It's just all these repetitions of this short little four-note theme. And so it was something he was kind of in the air, and he was drawing on that style, but he was sort of taking it out of that very specific political context and making it into something a little more abstract.
So taking the meaning out of context is something we're going to return to later in terms of what the Fifth has meant across centuries. But what are some of the other meanings that people have tried to put into it? I mean, some have said that Beethoven said that those first four notes symbolized fate knocking at the door.
Yeah, that's a story that comes from his biographer, Anton Schindler, who was also his secretary for a time, and a scholar of, shall we say, such variability that no one's quite sure whether to believe him on anything he says or not. But it was a pretty good story, and it stuck fairly soon. So that's always been the most widely known story attached to it. How much Beethoven actually meant for the piece to sound sort of revolutionary sentiments is something that, especially in recent years, has started to be explored again. And there are people who are trying to sort of return the piece to sort of a French Revolutionary context and really tracing the very specific links there, particularly in the finale, not so much in the first movement. Also, just there's been the Romantics got their hands on it, and so it became really their poster child for yearning for the infinite and trying to come up with some unity with the divine and all these other very open-ended and high-flown romantic concepts. So there's been a lot of ideas that have been sort of attached to the Fifth and also sort of drawn out of the Fifth with varying degrees of speculation.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about what Beethoven's contemporaries in the early 19th century themselves were saying. You sort of hinted at it just now, that it wasn't so much those first four notes that they were enthralled by, but rather this part of the symphony. So that is from the finale of Beethoven's Fifth.
That is from the finale.
Why were they in love with that more than the first four notes that we all look back on today?
Well, if you look at the piece, the trajectory of the piece as a whole, the fact that it starts in minor and then at the end goes into this very bright, triumphant major key, That was somewhat unusual for the time and the amount of energy with which he was able to do it, including sort of not having a break between the third and fourth movements. It goes right into it. They were all very impressed by that because of just sort of the dramatic possibilities of it. Interestingly, as sort of the century went on and as ideas of fate, the way people thought about it, went away from sort of this idea of a personal fate, like you have your own individual fate. And then as the 19th century went on, it sort of expanded to this idea of historical fate, and entire nations and humanity itself all had a fate. Interestingly, the attention starts to sort of gravitate back towards the first movement, mm-hmm. which is a little more fraught. It's a little more about struggle. It's a little more, it's not quite as triumphant. And in fact, there were people who, in that context, started to see the ending as not quite the triumph we thought it was. There's a famous story of Cosima Wagner, Richard's wife, who basically thought that the ending of the Fifth Symphony, she called it a lot of celebrating over nothing. and it was just a sign of how much the power of the piece had come to reside in that opening movement, and especially tracking that opening phrase all the way through all four movements of the piece.
Well, it's interesting how that opening phrase has really itself tracked its way through history.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's so much a product of its time. If it's his time, as we were talking about earlier, around the French Revolution, it's very disruptive and disorienting. But since then, it's been, you know, beloved by everyone from the writer Ralph Ellison to Nietzsche, Sartre, the American Transcendentalists. You have the Chinese Maoists, the Nazis and the Allies in World War II.
Yep.
I mean, the list goes on. I mean, is that essentially because, really, dare I even say this, that the Beethoven's Fifth is a meaningless piece, so we can imbue any meaning we want onto it?
Well, certainly it has acquired an astonishing range of meanings, and all of them with fairly high degrees of plausibility in many cases. I think what it is that it is in some ways a blank slate, but it does what it does with such rhetorical force that it just feels like there has to be some meaning in there. And it's this weird thing about music where it's very difficult to sort of pin down any specific meaning, especially if the composer isn't giving you a whole lot of information to go on in that regard. But it can acquire such force, it can feel so communicative, both in a very broad sense and in a very personal sense, that people almost are it's irresistible to try and attach some meaning to it. So, and the Fifth is really interesting just because it's been around so long and it's been famous for so long that it actually, both the interpretations that people put on it and just the fact that it's famous enough that everybody knows it, they actually start to reinforce each other for a mm-hmm. while. So you can almost track these interpretations that sort of take on a life of its own, and the way people react to the piece becomes a variation on these previous ways that people have reacted to the piece. It's an incredibly rich sort of progression.
Well, actually, there was one sort of branch of that progression which really caught my attention as we were reading about reading your book today, and that is back in 1810, E.T.A. Hoffmann, the author of The Nutcracker, wrote this really amazing review of Beethoven's Fifth, saying that Beethoven's music sets in motion the machinery of awe, of fear, of terror, of pain. It awakens that infinite yearning, which is the essence of romanticism. And then a century and a half later, here's Leonard Bernstein again, we heard him earlier, saying that that is exactly the key to the mystery of a great artist, that for reasons unknown, he gives his life to be sure that one note follows the next in perfect order.
Seems rather an odd way to spend one's life, but it isn't so odd when we think that the composer, by doing this, leaves us at the finish with a feeling that something is right in the world, that checks throughout, something that follows its own law consistently, something we can trust that will never let us down.
So, Matthew Guerrieri, in the last couple seconds that we have here, do you think Beethoven's Fifth will never let us down?
I don't think it will. I think it's the interesting thing is, even though we are so far away from it, even though it takes such effort to try and even imagine how it would have sounded to listeners in Beethoven's time, I think what we've seen is that for every generation that comes along, they find something else in the piece that gives it meaning for them, and it's one of those things. The fact that it's been around so long is now an integral part of of why it will stick around for that much longer.
Matthew Guerrieri is author of The First Four Notes, Beethoven's Fifth and the Human Imagination. He'll be at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge tomorrow night. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from theangle@boston.com. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.